Good evening, everybody. Welcome to main stage number one of Thin Air 2019. It's really great to have you here with us this evening for a show called Trust Me. My name is Charlene Deal. I'm the director of the Winnipeg International Writers Festival. This is my 17th festival, and it truly never gets old. We're excited every year, and we have a really great festival lined up. Had a really good day, first day yesterday, and we're settling into our regular weekday offerings, so we're very excited about that. Thank you for joining us. If you have a cell phone that's on, could you turn it into at least buzz mode? That helps us not to be distracted. Before we begin tonight, I would like to acknowledge that we're gathered on Treaty 1 territory. This is traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene peoples in the homeland of the Métis Nation. And here at the Forks, we're in a particularly resonant space, a place where people have gathered and traded goods and stories for thousands of years. And it is truly an honor and a responsibility to be sharing this space, so we're grateful to be here. I'd like to start tonight, since this is our first main stage, by doing a big shout out to MTYP, our host for this week. We love coming here, and the folks who make this place hum are great to work with and create a lovely, warm welcome for all of us, so we're very glad about that. I'd also like to acknowledge the bookstore, McNally Robinson Booksellers, the one and only, and one of the most important institutions in this city, I think, who are our sponsor for this evening. Will you please join me in thanking? We love McNally's. And I would like to do a little shout out also for the beautiful furniture up here, courtesy of Hut K Furniture, which is no longer in the Exchange, but is now in a really cool store down on Grant. You can see it set out in front of you. And if you decide to take home, you can't actually take it home from the theater because we need it. And the beautiful furniture models do not come with it, which is sad because I've met them all and I know they would be excellent accompaniments to your home. Great storytellers, very charming, very smart, and as far as I know, clean. And I'd also like to just make an acknowledgement to my small and fierce team, Bruce, Chelsea, Alina, Rich, Teresa, who have been moving mountains for the last several weeks and are just running like crazy and still smiling and joyful about things, as well as a whole posse of volunteers who help us to make this festival happen. So would you please join me in offering gratitude for that? So tonight, our theme is Trust Me. In the book chat this afternoon, we were talking a little bit about discovering characters and kind of wondering what they do and don't know, and how sometimes a storyteller might mislead you on purpose, or sometimes they mislead you because they have misled themselves, or sometimes they're operating with insufficient knowledge or insight. And all of the stories that you're going to hear tonight circle around issues of trust and dependability and all of the secrets that may or may not emerge. And what really fascinated me in our conversation this afternoon was this observation that in many ways the act of trying to figure something out, which is often what characters are doing, is also the parallels the act that readers are engaged in, trying to figure out, okay, are you telling me something that's true, accurate, manipulative, completely false? Is it, false news or alternate facts, or just kind of a description that is missing some important insights that might actually say quite a bit about character? So I believe that we are in for a treat, both as listeners and also as potential readers, as all of these very gifted writers take us through some fascinating territory. So we're going to open this evening with David Alberton, who comes to us from Toronto, although you will be able to tell in a moment that he may have a significant South African influence in there. That's all I will say. He's got a really, really fast, potent novel called Undercut. Will you please welcome David Alberton?
Hello. First, I'd like to say that the couch is very comfortable, so if you are planning to go to K-Hut, it's a good choice. Anyway, I'm very happy to be here. I'm so grateful to be invited to speak here, and thanks for everyone for coming out. My name's David Alberton. The book is Undercard. It's okay. Yes, I know, Shami. And it was released earlier this year, and it takes place over 24 hours in Las Vegas, and it deals with casinos, corrupt cops, revenge, and it follows four strange childhood friends now in their early 30s, and they're all back in their hometown on the same day, all their lives converging and conflicting. So, as Charlene said, it's generally the response about it has been how fast-paced it is, and it's exciting, and a lot of people have told me how quick they read it. And then also there's been some, focus on that it's boxing and sports is a big feature of it. But while it is, Undercard is an underdog sports story and a gritty crime thriller, it's what drives the book is the relationship between the four main characters and the tensions between them. So these characters, they haven't seen each other in a long time, and now they're all back together again, thrust together for this one combustible day where their kind of whole lives kind of come to a head. And I'm going to read a scene where three of these characters, Keenan, Antoine, and Tyron, and the fourth main character, Naomi, is referenced by them. They're seeing each other again for the first time in years. And just to set it up, they're meeting at this casino resort in Vegas where Antoine is going to later in the day fight in this major boxing event. And then Keenan is working as a security guard there because he was just gotten out of the police. He just resigned after he wrongfully shot and killed an unarmed teenager. And he's sort of got a bit of a disguise at the moment. And then Tyron has just gotten out of the Marines. He's been in the Marines for 11 years, and he's been in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's just back in town now and just hearing about all these crazy things happening with his old closest friends. So, and he's decided to go to the casino to see Antoine and reconnect. So that's the scene I'm going to read. Oh, and to go with the evening theme, there's some serious trust issues going on, to put it mildly. Waiting for them on the 21st floor is a tall security guard with a black beard, sunglasses, and a reef cap pulled low over his eyes. He starts the moment he sees Tyron, then turns his face as though to hide whatever surprise he felt, and motions for them to follow. Tyron complies, staring at the pistol holstered on the man's hip. The guard stops outside one of the doors and raises his fist to knock. He pauses and looks over at Tyron. "You want help with something?" Tyron asks. The man takes off his sunglasses and looks at him with pale blue eyes. "It's a fake beard, Tyron." Tyron checks the thin metal name tag on the man's chest. "Davis." "The name's fake, too." Tyron squints at the man, and then his jaw drops. "Keenan?" The man gives a self-conscious smile. "There is no doubt. Keenan." They hesitantly embrace. "Damn, it's been long," Tyron says. "Another lifetime," says Keenan. Tyron steps back. He stares into Keenan's eyes. "You all right? I got back yesterday. You're all anyone is talking about." "Not now." Emotions cross Keenan's face in waves. He starts to speak, freezes, then repeats, "Not now. It's good to see you, though. I can't remember. It's good to see you. You remember my boy Ricky, right? We all played ball back in the day." "I remember. What's up, man?" Keenan holds out his hand, then drops it as Ricky keeps his at his side. Tyron's face tightens. He is ready to shake some sense into Ricky, but Keenan stalls him with a look. "It's okay. It's a better reception than most people give me these days." "How'd you end up here?" Keenan shrugs. I'm off the force, needed a new job. Tyrone nods toward the door, beyond which their old friend waits. You spoken to Antoine? No, Keenan says. He doesn't know you're out here? Not yet. You want me to tell him? Keenan thinks about it, then nods. Sure, tell him. Better he has some warning. We haven't spoken in over 10 years. Even Naomi hasn't spoken to him in years. Naomi. Tyrone feels like he's been sucker punched. He tries to keep his voice level. How is Naomi? She's good. She's good. We're good. Sounds good. She coaches now. I heard that. My cousin told me. Right, Tara. They're friends. Yeah, Tyrone says, thinking that there are 1,000 other things he wants to know about Naomi. Why did she retire? Does she like coaching? Have her features softened or sharpened with age? Does she still smile as easily or laugh as effortlessly? Is her scent the same? Does she miss me? Does she think about me? Does she still love me? He takes a breath. You guys got kids? Keenan shakes his head, staring at Tyrone with his sad blue eyes. Tyrone is embarrassed at how much relief he feels. He thought he had let her go, realizes now that he had just been distracted. It would take 2 wars to push a woman like Naomi to the back of your mind. So Antoine's world class now? Tyrone says, attempting to change the subject. This for real? Keenan shrugs. I never understood Antoine back when we were kids, and I sure as hell don't understand him now. Tyrone nods, remembering. He looks at the door to Antoine's suite. I better go in. Keenan backs down the hallway. Good luck. The door is opened by a wiry Hispanic man, black tattoos snaking up and down his neck, creeping out from beneath the sleeves of his white shirt onto the backs of his hands. He says nothing to Tyrone, merely looks him and Ricky over, then steps aside, opening the door wider. Tyrone glances back as he steps inside, but Keenan is gone. Not a room for a high roller, but the suite is spacious enough. A second Latino man, this one middle-aged and weather-beaten, but also wiry and strong, gets up off a sofa and shuffles to another room, with the first man following behind. The third man in the room stands before the floor-to-ceiling windows, looking out over the Vegas skyline. The red, dusty mountains visible in the distance are jagged against the deep blue of the Nevada sky. The man turns to them, his eyes dark, calculating. I didn't think I'd ever see you again. Antoine's voice, weightier than Tyrone remembered. Sorry to show up out of nowhere. Antoine says nothing, just stares at Tyrone, who feels his insides shifting in preparation for action. It's an instinct he developed while in the Middle East, a sixth sense for violence. Trouble didn't always follow this feeling, but when it hit, he was always forewarned. Who's this? Antoine finally says. Ricky strides forward. Hey, man, you remember your homeboy Rick, right? We had some battles on the court back in the... I gotta speak to Tyrone alone, Antoine cuts in. You don't mind waiting outside, right? Yeah, kind of. Ricky looks over at Tyrone, who nods toward the door. Ricky sucks on his teeth, looking from one to the other. Oh, okay, whatever. Tyrone watches as Ricky, deflated, retreats out the door. I see you haven't lost your charming disposition. Antoine's face remains impassive. What are you doing here? Honestly, Ricky wants tickets to the fight tonight. He hassled me to hit you up. I only got back to Vegas yesterday. From protecting our foreign interests, there is derision in the question. That's right. You still with them? The Marines? Yes, the Marines. No, I'm not. How come? Got tired of killing Muslims? With the question, Antoine's dispassionate face breaks into a spiteful smile. Tyrone feels himself stiffen. If he were to tell the truth, he would say yes. He was tired of killing the first time he had to do it, and he never stopped tiring of it. I never planned on being in the Corps for the rest of my life. It was time for something new. Which will be what? Finding another way to kill people of color? You can be like Keenan and join the police. If you want me to leave, just say so. I didn't come here for this. Of course you didn't come here for this, Antoine growls. Of course you didn't. You came here, after years without a word, looking for a handout. That's what you came for. Tyrone exhales heavily. He isn't used to civilians sniping at him like this. It makes his pulse thump. You're just like everyone else I used to know. You know what they say to me, all these ghosts from my past? Ever since I got out of prison and started winning, and especially when it became clear I wasn't going to stop winning, they all say the same thing. Don't forget me when you're famous. Don't forget me when you make it. Don't forget me, don't forget me, don't forget me. And you know what I think each time I hear that? Don't remember me when I make it. Don't remember me. If you weren't with me when I was homeless, if you weren't with me when I was on the streets, if you weren't with me in prison, don't fucking remember me now. You couldn't visit me inside. You couldn't write me a letter. You couldn't send me a fucking email. And I shouldn't forget you? Don't worry, I don't. I don't forget who you are. Not ever. Tyrone returns the cold stare leveled at him. I don't remember any letters from you when I was in Iraq or Afghanistan. Antoine smiles. Good point. He takes a sudden step toward Tyrone, whose muscles begin vibrating. I always think of your parents when I see you, Antoine says. You look like them. Tyrone gives a brief nod. He struggles to find something to say. Can't find the words to bridge the gap between them. You ever wonder who killed them? Tyrone is so taken aback that he physically steps backward. Antoine is studying him closely now. I stopped thinking about that a long time ago. Why? Antoine hesitates on the verge of saying something. Then his face smooths and grows unreadable. Just curious. Tyrone says, Keenan's outside. What? Keenan's working security at the hotel. He walked us in. He's waiting outside. Antoine's eyes bulge with anger. Then he turns away and laughs. It is fate. He turns back to Tyrone. It is fate, he says softly, his eyes imploring. All of us here together again on this day of all days. It's a sign. Something momentous is about to happen. His eyes flash and the hint of a smile appears on his lips. Tyrone watches Antoine. He wonders how quickly he can get out of the room if things take a turn. Antoine's speech is rushed, his mind clearly racing now. I'll get you and Ricky into the fight. You can wait in the casino. I'll give you money. He turns and shouts to the bedrooms. Carlos, $300 y dos boletos para la pelea. Back to Tyrone, he says. Give your number to Carlos. He'll handle the details. He jolts forward and puts his hand on Tyrone's shoulder. Tyrone almost flinches, half expecting a punch. You got my back, right? Antoine says urgently. If shit goes down, you got my back, right? What do you mean? Like in the ring? I don't need help in the ring. If other shit goes down, you... Like what? Whatever. It doesn't matter what. If things happen, you look out for me, okay? Whether we were ever brothers or not, your parents loved me. You remember that. Your parents loved me and I loved them. You look out for me tonight, yeah? Yeah, all right, man, I will. Antoine stares into his eyes, searching, and finally gives a short nod, satisfied. Carlos, the young man with the tattoos, waits silently behind them. I'll see you later, Antoine says. Send Keenan in when you leave. Antoine walks over to Carlos, whispers something to him, and walks back to the window. Carlos approaches a wad of cash and two tickets in his hands. Tyrone exchanges numbers, takes the tickets, but refuses the cash. Across the hotel suite, he says, Hey, Antoine. Antoine turns, his gaunt face half silhouetted. Good luck tonight. The boxer stares for so long, Tyrone thinks there will be no other reaction. But at last it comes, a one-sided smile.
You just gotta know more. You just gotta. Thank you, David. That's David Alberton. The dialogue is so sharp, and those characters are so gripping. Our next writer is not a stranger to audiences here. Lauren Carter has been on this stage a few times and is a longtime friend of the festival, but she's also really folded herself into the writing community here in the Winnipeg area and in the previous years up near the Paw, where she lived for some time. She's a great poet, but she's coming to us tonight with a new novel called This Has Nothing to Do With You. Please welcome Lauren Carter.
Good evening. I am very, very grateful to be here tonight. Thank you. My book is just out this month, and it's about a brother and a sister, Matt and Mel, who are coming to terms with the fact that their mother murdered their father and his mistress. And it's set in 1994. And Mel has recently adopted a very challenging rescue dog, formerly named Sunday and now called Gromit. I don't know what to do. All I can think is to keep trying, keep my head down, push forward, hoping sooner or later things will click into place. Gromit will get used to being home alone. He'll sleep instead of destroying my stuff. We'll settle in together, a happy family. This is, after all, what I learned growing up. Don't admit there's a problem. Pretend everything's fine. Lie if you have to. Don't rock the boat. So I hold to the bucking hull, and the next day, Thursday, I come home to find Mrs. Slater, the old lady who lives in the apartment next to mine, standing in her open doorway. "You've got a beast in there," she says, jerking her head towards my apartment. Her coiffed white hair does not move. I clamp down on the frisson of panic and pull out my key, playing dumb, sliding my eyes from her face to the wall like I'm looking for whatever creature she's talking about. "I've got a goldfish," I lie, "and I might have left the TV on." She crosses her arms, dark arrows of rouge color each of her cheeks. Her lips gleam with a fresh coat of lipstick. We stare at each other until, thankfully, her phone starts ringing and she pulls back, shuts the door. When I shove my key in the lock, I hear Gromit gallop towards me and my heart sinks. Every day I try to enter quietly, hoping he'll be sleeping. When I hear him race away, I turn the key, bracing for whatever destruction I'll find. When I flick on the light, my mouth drops open. My couch has exploded. The upholstery ripped apart, torn bits of foam erupting out of holes dug deep into the cushions. A powdery yellow drift spreads across the living room carpet, the kitchen linoleum, and the air smells pungent like dirty feet. Gromit stands in the corner beside the bookshelf, his fur spotted with flakes, his eyes tipped up nervously. He's trembling, I see, and I realize that he's becoming used to this moment, me coming home, getting upset. He's growing afraid of my reaction. So far, this is the only training we've done. Consciously, I uncross my arms, then lick my lips, imitating the body language that dogs use to diffuse tension. He yawns fiercely, his face quaking, and I yawn back. Slowly, he plods over, pushes his big body against my leg. "What happened here?" I whisper, touching the velvet softness of his ear. Shoved between the couch arm and what remains of one of the cushions, I find the scrap of a plastic baggie holding a scattering of Parmesan cheese. Gromit found it on the counter, I deduce, dragged it to the couch, ripped it open, and dug in. Soon, unable to determine what was Parmesan and what was yellow foam, coated in a delicious cheese scent. Surrounded by the mess, I pluck the phone off my kitchen wall and dial. Liv answers right away. "Norbury no-kill animal shelter." "It's Mel," I say. "Gromit ate my couch." "Who?" "Sunday." I explain what happened and she starts laughing. Then when I say, "Last weekend he bit my best friend's husband," she laughs even harder once I tell her it wasn't serious, although I don't actually know. Behind me, Gromit barks. I turn, trying to shush him with my hand, knowing that Mrs. Slater is probably leaning her ear against the other side of my wall. He's on his hind legs, pawing at the glass as a seagull flies by. I stretch the cord to the TV and turn on Much Music, playing a video of the Cranberries. "I don't know if I can," I say, and realize right then that I'm actually really close to tears. But Liv interrupts. "It hasn't even been a week. You knew it wouldn't be easy." The confession erupts. "I'm not even allowed to have pets here, and I have to go to work, and I can't leave him at night. I can't go anywhere. I can't even keep volunteering with you." I take a breath, expecting her to say something, to ask for clarification. "What do you mean dogs aren't allowed?" The shame of the lie, or more specifically, the lack of full disclosure, has heated my cheeks, and I chew my bottom lip, waiting for Liv's anger, but all she does is sigh. "You have to figure it out, Mel," she says. I try again, but maybe I'm not. "Jesus," she says, all laughter now gone. "Really?" Neither of us speak. I rip a fingernail with my teeth. I want to say, "He isn't at all like Frankie. He won't even let me scratch his belly. He doesn't like water. I can see the panic in his eyes." "I have to go," Liv says. "Somebody found a litter of puppies in a garbage bag at the dump. He got them out just in time, but the one at the bottom was dead." The horror of that sits in me for a moment, and then puppies, I think. Maybe I should have opted for a blank slate. A dog I can, I fumble to find the words to say this out loud, to present this as an option, but she's hung up. When the phone rings again, I lunge. I'm sorry, Liv, I say, ready to tell her I'll try harder. I still love him. He's still my dog. But I don't hear anything on the other end except the distant rumble of my brother's voice saying something about extra cheese. Matt? Mel? Matt says, too loud, nearly shouting. Can you do me a favor? His voice is loose and sloppy, like braided rope that sat too long in water. I tense, alert to strangeness. Can you tell Ange I'm a good guy? What? I'm a good dad. I'm not like our dad. Okay, I hear Ange say, stern. And then there's a fumbling rustle for the phone, Matt laughing, a high-pitched cackle I've never heard before. You're a good dad, I say, but neither of them hear. He is a good dad because he's a good person. You're the best of us, my mother said to him, her slender hand clutching his across the table so hard her knuckles were blanched. That was the last time I'd seen her. Mel, Ange asks, what's going on? She doesn't answer. Has he been drinking? I look at my watch. It's 4:46. We're planning a party, she says. At first he didn't want anything, and now he does. She sounds tired. I pinch the skin on my forehead, close my eyes. Shit, I mutter, because I missed his birthday. It was yesterday. I'd been looking forward to it, too, to taking him out for dinner, doing something fun. The last time I helped him celebrate was in 1990, after Mom had driven down to Toronto to get him, to bring him home for the summer. Mysteriously, they came back sick and injured, Matt with a purple and yellow bruise on his jaw, my mom claiming she had food poisoning, disappearing into her room for days. You should see the other guy, Matt joked, but I never found out what happened. Maybe I asked, likely I asked, but neither of them gave me an answer. That night, April 20th, I stuck a candle into a bowl of macaroni and cheese and gave him the new Sinead O'Connor cassette I'd actually bought for myself. We watched the tribute concert for Nelson Mandela that Matt had taped, ears alert to movements in the house, listening for potential arguments. This time, though, I don't even have a gift. For a split second, I think of giving him grommet. They have a backyard, a big enough house, and Angie is home, but she's already told me she isn't a dog person. Maybe a fish would be better. A lonely Siamese fighting fish with bright, fluttering red or green fins, a couple of silver tetras, something to remind him of who he used to be, how much he'd enjoyed keeping fish when we were kids, how our mirror-lined basement den had glittered with the color and light of his aquarium, filled with blue-green chromies, orange and blue Australian damselfish, the Lubox fairy race, that magical red and yellow creature with twinkling blue eyes that we called the fairy fish. Josie, Lara, and I had played mermaid in that room, running around until my mother stomped on the floor, warning us, different from other mothers, who'd bring us celery sticks stuffed with raisin-studded peanut butter or baked chocolate birthday cakes filled with saran-wrapped quarters. She'd rather we hadn't been in the house at all, I'm sure, that she could have kept the space to herself, danced away the hours in the room my father had lined with mirrors for her when I was 7. For what? So she could practice and stage a solo dance performance in the high school gymnasium, selling tickets during the annual ice fishing derby? Raffle off a snowmobile as a door prize? None of that mattered anyway, because it wasn't long before he'd taken the room away, filling it with furniture and a second TV. The party's tomorrow night, Angie says. I'm not sure. I already know I can't possibly go. How can I leave Grommet that long on his own? Short notice, I know, but like I said, it's not that. She waits. When I don't continue, she says, and wear 80s clothes. It's an 80s party. I roll my eyes. The 80s were only 5 years ago, and yet things are so different. I'm not sure what she means. Fashion, politics, music, herself, her own life, or Matt's. There's so much more, Midge. Matt said to me the first time we talked after he moved to Toronto, a 7-hour drive south of Hickson River to go to university. There was a breathlessness in his voice and excitement, his future beginning while I stayed behind, hiding in my room. "Come for him," Angie says. "It's your brother's birthday." I look over at Gromit, stretched the length of the glass door on my balcony, chin on the door, black lips sagging, his copper and pitch coat littered with cheese he hasn't completely licked off. I'll have to bathe him, I realize. I wonder how that will go. I think of telling Angie his whole sad story, but then there's a dull thud. The baby starts to scream. I'll see about the party, I tell her, but she's already hung up. I set the phone down, refill Gromit's water bowl, and when I turn back around, he's up, lifting his leg in the corner of the room. Thank you very much.
I feel so much more confirmed now about not being a dog owner. Thank you, Lauren Carter. And our third voice this evening is Oakland Ross, who also comes to us from Toronto. He's got a really magical novel called Swimming with Horses. Please welcome Oakland Ross.
Thank you, all of you, for coming out tonight. It's really a pleasure to have so many people to read to. I want to. Do anybody here? Do you know that there's a program on the CBC Radio called "Things the Age of Influence"? Terry O'Reilly is always about advertising. It's really, really interesting always. And he was talking one time about you used to have something called an elevator pitch, and that was you had a couple of minutes to sell somebody on an idea, and you would do it while you were riding in an elevator. So it had to be very quick. But Terry O'Reilly said that the idea of an elevator pitch is now obsolete because people don't have enough time to listen to a pitch on an elevator. So he said it's been replaced by something called the escalator pitch. And this means you're traveling on an escalator in the opposite direction of the person you want, whose attention you want to catch. So you've got 2-3 seconds to catch them. And so I thought I should have an escalator pitch for my novel. And it is as follows. The anti-apartheid struggle on horseback.
That's good.
This is the first time I've had a chance to use it. My novel is called Swimming with Horses, and it is actually about swimming with horses, which can be both a very benign, even magical pastime, or it can be treacherous. And the novel, it has two sort of threads. It's set partly in southern Ontario horse country in 1963, and partly in apartheid-era South Africa in 1962. And those two stories come together eventually, and in fact are intertwined as the story goes along. The first sentence of chapter one of the novel is, "Her name was Hilary Anson, and she came up from South Africa during the late spring of 1963, armed with a Russian-made Makarov pistol that had been given to her by Nelson Mandela, or so she said." And the novel goes from there. This very mysterious scandal-plagued young woman named Hilary Anson, 18 years old at the time of the novel, shows up in a fictional area of southern Ontario called Kelso County, and causing great outrage or scandal among the very conservative denizens of that community. And the story of what happens during the summer of 1963, as the narrator, a young 15-year-old named Sam Mitchell, who falls absolutely in love with her, and that thread unfolds. Meanwhile, it is interspersed with a narrative in South Africa that took place the year before and involved a great deal of scandal and a great many very unpleasant circumstances. I was thinking, when I was thinking of the theme of Trust Me for tonight, that one aspect of trust, in addition to, as Charlene was talking about, unreliable narrators and either deliberate or inadvertent misguiding of the reader, and that's certainly one factor of trust. Another factor is, does the writer of this book actually know what he or she is talking about? And either you do or you don't. If you do, then that's lucky. If you don't, then you better do a good job of disguising that fact, or else, you know, do a lot of research. I've written two previous novels, both of which were historical novels, and that meant I couldn't directly know what was going on because I wasn't remotely born yet. And so that meant there was a great deal of research. And the first of those novels was called The Dark Virgin. And it took place during the Spanish conquest of Mexico. And of course, I wasn't there at the scene. But it took an incredible amount of research. And I ended up doing one rewrite after another rewrite. And there would be the food rewrite. And then there would be the modes of transportation rewrite. And then there would be the military weaponry rewrite. And on and on and on until I... And the vegetation rewrite. Which was even worse because then you had to recall that, oh, no, this is back in, you know, 1516, really. And so the trees that exist in Mexico nowadays were the same trees that existed in 1516, which, of course, they were not. So it became quite onerous. I found it delightful, although obviously very frustrating, as all novels are, to write this book because half of it is set... not only during my lifespan, but also in the area of the world where I grew up. I grew up on a horse farm northwest of Toronto. And so all of the parts of the novel that pertained to the care and feeding of these wonderful animals was something I already knew a lot about and didn't have to research. And that was a very refreshing experience for me. The South African portions of the novel were a bit more challenging. I used to live in Zimbabwe for several years, which is just north of South Africa, and whose white Anglo settler colony is culturally very similar to its counterpart in South Africa. And that simplified things. Also, I did travel quite a lot in South Africa, both in apartheid times and after apartheid times, and that helped as well. But I found the most difficult thing was trying to capture South African idiom and learning a lot of words in South African English that don't exist in Canadian English, like granch, which is making out sort of sexually. So granching. And another word which we would pronounce as lekker, but South Africans, I think, would say lekka. And that means anything really, really nice. And then they're just, you know, idioms in South Africa, the use of where we would say a, South Africans would say hey. And also, they words come up very, very often, or expressions like ag, or shame, or a pleasure, for pleasure. I had to, you know, learn all these and try to write in a South African diction that was remotely accurate. And it all fell apart here in Winnipeg. When I found out I was going to be reading on the same panel with this guy, because all the times I've read from this book beforehand, I've done a South African accent, which you don't want to hear, because it sort of sounds like a Russian accent. And, of course, I had to abandon all the sections I thought I was going to read, because they would just sound ridiculous. So I'm going to read a section. I'm quickly going to set it up. Takes place toward the end of the novel when the South African narrative is nearing its climax. And at this point, the girl with the pistol, and it's important to remember the pistol because that is an element, Hilary Anson, she and her South African black boyfriend, who was sent to jail because of a setup, but he managed to escape. And now they are trying to escape from South Africa, because they have to, on horseback, from a town called Mooi River, where she grew up on a horse farm owned by her father, and they want to get to a place called, well, in those days it was called Basuto Land, which is high in the Drakensberg Mountains, and it was, in those days, an English protectorate entirely surrounded by South Africa. It's nowadays known as the Kingdom of Lesotho, again, entirely surrounded by South Africa, but it's an independent country. Anyway, they're trying to escape there, and everything was going pretty well until they reached the banks of the Tsoelike River. It's in the wintertime in South Africa, and there's been a vast amount of snowfall, which sometimes happens in the Drakensberg. It's melted, and now the river is a raging, raging torrent, which they don't think they're going to be able to get across. But they try. And you have to, there's one piece of tack, a horse, equestrian tack, I'll explain to you because it figures in the section. It's called a standing martingale. Some horses have a bad tendency to throw their heads wildly, and to counteract that, it'd be better to train them not to, but if you haven't got much time, you use something called a standing martingale. It's a piece of leather that goes around the horse's shoulders, attaches behind their forelegs to the girth to hold it in place, and then there's a latch of leather that comes up to a ring, and you attach it to the noseband under the jaw of the horse, and that stops the horse from throwing its head. But this turns out to be a big problem when they try to ford the Tsualike River. Sorry. Okay. What happens is Hillary decides to jump into the water with her horse, whose name is Southwind, or Southie, in spite of the raging torrent that it has become. And then she remembers that she's failed to remove the detach the standing martingale, so the horse can't get his head above water. Hillary was so cold she could barely control the movement of her hands. She thought she would perish from exposure if she didn't drown first. Meanwhile, Southwind struggled with the current, pacing against the river's flow. Somehow he'd got his head swung out to the side, got his nostrils clear. In brief, frenzied snorts, he managed to breathe the only way that horses can breathe, through the nose. Meanwhile, he kept striding sideways through the water's rush, and it worked. By God, it worked. Gradually, stroke by stroke, he managed to shoulder his way through the surging water, but it was hard going. Southie could barely breathe, and it was a good question how long he would keep his head twisted around like that. He was bound to tire before long, tire and then drown. By now, Hillary had got her left hand around the noseband on Southie's bridle. In her other hand, she clutched his mane. Numb though she was, she fumbled at the buckle, tried to release the noseband, tried to free the martingale so that Southie could raise his head clear of the water. Damn, damn, damn. She couldn't bloody well move her fingers, and she could get no purchase, cold as she was, borne downstream with only a horse's mane to hold on to. Oh, Southie, oh, you poor, beautiful boy. He coiled his shoulders and damn near performed a cartwheel in the water before flopping again onto his belly, his head again beneath the roiling surface. He thrust his shoulders up again, freed his muzzle, and shrieked into the cold air, a sound she'd never heard a horse make before, a wail of panic or of anger. Sever this frigging leather. Remove these fetters from me. That was what he was trying to do. Tear these leather straps that dare to restrict my glorious head. He jerked and thrashed, sprayed shouts of frigid water that arched through the gray daylight, but he could not hold his nostrils clear. She knew it, and somehow he must have known it too. Still, he kept kicking through the water, even as his muscles burned, even as his neck began to weaken and wilt. Hillary realized they were advancing almost to the banks on the far side of the river. Before long, she felt her shoulders brushing against the low, drooping boughs of trees. She thought she might be able to grasp one of those branches and possibly pull herself to safety. The idea raced through her head like a phantom, like a thought that wasn't really there. In that same instant, she remembered the gun, the one they'd got from Nelson Mandela. She stopped struggling with the martingale. She knew she could never work it free. Somehow she thought of the gun. Instead, she thought of the gun. She frigging well needed that gun. She released her grip on Southie's house noseband. She swung herself around, still gripping Southie's mane. Somehow, despite the crazy trembling of her fingers, she managed to yank the weapon from the saddlebag and then shove the pistol in its waterproof cover into a side pocket of her parka. The riverbank rushed by, and she caught sight of a tree branch racing toward her just overhead, bending low over the water. Without pausing to think, without actually making a decision, she thrust out her right arm. Oh, Southie, oh, my splendid one. She snagged the branch with her raised arm and then hurled herself up, wrapping both her arms around that blessed limb, praying it would hold. She wasn't sure Southwind even knew what she had done. He would never know that she had betrayed him in the end, left him to drown after he had saved her. She caught a glass glimpse of that wondrous beast, dwindling with the current, his head still flailing from side to side, his shoulders yawing, his neck lowering in what must have been a state of monstrous exhaustion, and she never set eyes on him again. Thank you.
Oakland Ross, wow, what a great reading. What a gripping. Are we all okay? We're all okay? That is the first half complete. Will you please give one really warm round of applause for all three of our writers? And now I invite you to come forward, talk to the writers, buy copies of the book. You can get something at the bar. If you haven't had a chance already to put your door prize ballot into that fancy box over there, someone in this room is going to win tonight's books. And I think it's possible that the webcam covers are over there. Is that correct, Selena? Okay, so I thought, you know, given the theme of, like, trust and maybe lack of trust, I wanted to tell you about this really cool little thing that we got this year for our writers, and that tonight can be also for you. They're very funky little webcam covers you can put on your computer. Has a little sort of a sliding door, so you can actually cover up that eyeball, which is always looking at you when you're at your computer. So they're pretty cool, and they're over there. You can have a look and take one home with you if you like. Please come forward. I neglected to mention earlier that we have a stool sitting over there with no one on it, and it will be here all week. This is part of our participation with a project run by Pen Canada called Empty Chair, and each festival we partner up with Pen Canada, which is an advocacy organization for writers who have been silenced, jailed, sometimes killed for speaking their truth. So there is a petition in the lobby for you to sign, and it will be actually at all of the Thin Air events. This year, our writer is Nazrin Sotoudeh, who is an Iranian human rights lawyer who has been jailed and threatened with lashes and really very in a very, very scary situation. So I encourage you to sign the petition. And I did want to say, I think in the last couple of months, one of the writers that we stood with, that you, all of you who signed the petition stand with, was actually freed. I believe he was a journalist in, Rich, do you remember? Ukraine, was it? Yeah, I think that's right. So I know from some of the conversations that I've had with people in higher power positions than I that the signatures of regular citizens who stand in alliance with an organization like Pen Canada really do make a difference because they apply pressure to governments who are mistreating their writers. And at a writers' festival, it's just particularly pertinent and relevant because we are here enjoying the freedom that we have in this country to speak and tell the stories that we dream. So please do take a minute. And I should have mentioned it earlier and I didn't, but now I have. So the second half of Trust Me, we have two more writers to share with you. And the first writer for the second half is Christian Gay-Paliquin, who comes here from Montreal. He's also going to be on our French stage, and he's going to share an English translation. His novel's called The Weight of Snow. He's been here before, and he's a favorite of ours. So please welcome Christian Gay-Paliquin.
I was at that mic tree years ago, and I remember frozen in front of that mic. So this year, I came prepared, so my ideas won't melt, you know, in my mouth. Basically, The Weight of Snow, it's a novel about caregiving, intergenerational friendship, and conflict. It's always weird what I want to say before. It's a little bit more general about literature, but it's really, I really believe it deeply. You know, it's always weird to see how much imaginary is necessary to inhabit the world. In that way, the imaginary is a kind of an inalienable house. On one side, it windows. open on yesterday. On the other side, of course, they open on tomorrow. Its color changes according to the season. Its foundation plunges into invisible solidity of things. And its doors, of course again, are always open. If the imaginary is a house, literature is then a vast landscape that appeals us all in one way or another to ensure the collective dimension of our world. Yes, this great territory is ours, but is ours not to own, is ours to tell, to write, to hear and read, so we can and we must ensure his integrity. We all know the next decades will be decisive. All the catastrophist, world-ending, and post-apocalyptic fictions are there to remind us something from the future. Although, if it's good here to celebrate literature, perhaps it's also necessary to put it on the wall, to know what it can tell us beyond its good stories. If there are writings, that there are overflowing papers, that are laughing at centuries, that are changing and blowing minds, is that fiction, precisely, speaks to us in a sharpness, with a sharpness and a sensibility that are missing too often in our everyday life. So perhaps we can find, in my last novel, a winter whose fury evokes the fragility of our tomorrows and our total subordination to the cycle of season. Who knows? And who knows how to beat the storm when it hits? So I'll read then a short extract of The Weight of Snow, an extract where exactly after a few months, to put, you know, the situation, after a few months of remission because of his broken legs, my main character go out by himself, you know, outside for the very first time. Of course, he wants to see by his own eyes what happened to the village since the nationwide power outage. And of course, on his way back, he gets stuck in a snowstorm. I look up and try to situate myself in this empty landscape. Around me, everything is white. Around me, everything is black. To one side, I can make out the dark line of the forest. It's the only sign that I'm not moving through a desert. I begin to climb towards the house. The slope is steeper than I thought. My breathing is labored. My leg is numb from the effort. I'll make it, I'll make it, I'll make it. I know I will. I hang onto my poles for dear life. I move like a snowplow down a mountain road, keeping my eyes dead ahead so I won't be tempted by the precipice. Sweat runs down my skin and makes my clothes heavy. I must not stop, I must not stop, I must not stop. My body heat will disappear in a second if I will, and I will not be able to fend off the cold. I must be halfway there. The wind tears at my coat. I try to make out the shape of the house at the top of the hill, but it's too dark now, and the snow is blinding. I push forward, concentrating at the cold air rushing into my lungs, which each step my wounds could open. And then, as I shift my weight, thinking of the comforting immobility of my splints, my left leg gives way, and I collapse. When I reach the house, I will get undressed and bundle up in a big wool blanket. A fire will be burning in the fireplace. Matthias will put the soup on, and maybe there will be black bread. And I will eat then everything he sets down in front of me. And when I fall asleep, watch over by the light and the heat of the flames. But when I open my eyes, I'm still lying on the ground, and it's snowing like crazy. I roll over, I struggle, I try to get up, but I only sink deeper. The cold is holding me down. Every movement weighs a ton, and I have no more strength. My leg has stopped sending me pain signals. I don't feel it anymore. I should have taken shelter with Jonas in the stable. I would have been comfortable in the straw between a donkey and an ox. I would have been warm. Ice is forming knots on my coats and hats and gloves. I must not stop. I must not stop. I must get up. I'm almost there. I steer into action, propping myself up on my elbows. I crawl. I twist. I drag myself along the snow. I make a little progress, though it feels like I'm sinking, pulled down by icy underground currents. I move more and more slowly. My hands are completely frozen. Maybe I should do that like the old Matthias and pray. The blizzard holds. It's impatient, eager to cover me up, to embrace me and close over me. It salivates above me before it devours my body. I curled up to keep warm. I am like everybody else. I cannot accept the possibility of my death. Like everybody else, I deny it, and I pretend to be immortal. I try to stay calm. I try to stay calm. I try to stay calm, but my breath is out of control. I can't stay here. I have to keep moving. The snow is a bed of cutting crystals. I have to stand up, but the cold won't let me. And I refuse. I refuse to go this way, bend into myself, face to the ground. So I gather my courage and roll into my back, my arms outstretched, palms open to the sky. This might be it. I look up to the darkness. Around me, shadow prowl. The night is hungry, and the snow carnivorous. Thank you.
I think he's been cold a couple of times. That was a great reading, Christian Gay-Palekin. We're really glad to have you back. And our final reader for this evening is Adam Folds, who comes to us from Toronto. But as you hear him speak, you will know that perhaps he has another country of origin. He's a very gifted novelist, and he comes to us with a new book called Dream Sequence. Please welcome Adam Folds.
Thank you. So Dream Sequence is a contemporary set novel. And it has two central characters, one of whom is Henry. He's an actor who's become very successful in one job, a show a bit like Downton Abbey, which has made him very famous, but now is over. And he's anxiously ambitious for his future and struggling to make himself a kind of international movie star. So he's full of kind of self-criticism and neurosis and hunger, literal hunger. We're going to join him during a period in which he's starving himself for a role that requires a lot of weight loss. The other central character is a fan of his called Kristin, who he's met. He doesn't remember this, but she very much does. A few years ago, she has become convinced that they are twin souls, in her estimation, that they are destined to be together, that this is what the universe wants, and she, through the course of the novel, will do what it takes to bring this about, and sets off to find him. Where I'm going to read, we join Henry at a film festival in Doha, in Qatar, so in that kind of weird gulf world of desert and skyscraper and vast wealth. I wanted to read this section because it touches a bit on the theme of this evening, this idea of kind of trust. We'll see him with another character who is an actress who has been in the film, which is the reason that they're at this film festival. And I want to say that he, while he's very kind of compelled by his desires and his fears, he also and he's living this kind of single life. We see him having kind of one night stands, and his life feels, looks kind of suspect and unstable, unsolid. He kind of feels that himself. He can hear that there's kind of a rattle in the engine, and there's something wrong, and that he needs to kind of pull over and fix it. But he's got things that he wants to do, places he wants to get to, and so he keeps putting that off. And I think this encounter, this moment, is one of those points where he is feeling that. So, as I say, he's been starving himself to lose weight. Here at this film festival, he's given himself a bit more leeway and has actually eaten a bit more like a normal person. After breakfast, Henry felt unusually happy. That was the name he gave to the brightness of energy, the painless ease in his body that he hadn't felt for a very long time. He went for a swim in the hotel pool. A flat heat pressed down from above as he made his way around an archipelago of linked areas and back again beneath the feet of the few people on sun loungers. The sky above the hotel was a brilliant vacancy. The thrill of getting out of London and Britain was the change of light, Henry always noticed it, away from the sluggish mid-tones, the whey-white skies, the road greys and brick browns, out to some Mediterranean sparkle or sharp-shadowed North American winter sunlight, or this geographical extreme, the bare furnace of the desert. He became aware of where he was, splashing about in this receptacle of water, in this leisure facility, improbably placed at the whim of improbable wealth where the planet only burns. He made another circuit and then stood up, sweeping his hair back from his forehead and leaning back with his elbows on the edge. He saw the director of A Paper Fortune, that's the name of the film that he's in, Tom, the director, walking to a small table where Laura Harris sat. Henry, his shoulders already instantly dry, submerged again with a shiver and swam towards them. He bounced out of the pool, surging up onto his fingertips, a vertical rush as impressive as he could make it. He picked up the towel from the nearest lounger and cloaked his shoulders. The paving was hot now, though, so he had to return to his own chair with jerky steps to collect his flip-flops. While he was there, he put on his sunglasses and shaped his hair. He went back, carrying his T-shirt in one hand. "Aye, aye," Henry said. "Oh, look," Tom said, "it's your co-star, and he has a six-pack, no, an eight-pack. Just jealous." Henry pulled on his T-shirt, his display over. "Hi, Laura, how are you?" Some faces are composed by cameras, aligned and heightened into a beauty that is hard to see in the flesh, but the beauty of some faces is never fully caught on screen. Laura Harris was obviously unusually attractive. Everybody knew that who had seen her image and her work, but the reality of her breathing presence was something else. Henry was used to being among the beautiful. It was in the nature of his profession. Actors were hired in part because they were sexually attractive to the audience. Even if their roles weren't specifically erotic, the audience speculated about having sex with them and discussed their relative attractiveness. Henry was so used to it, in fact, that once or twice out among civilians in London, he'd been shocked to see what groups of people looked like when they hadn't been filtered by their appearance, the lumpiness, the dinginess and disarray. The physical beauty of actors was often at odds with their dim or tiresome personalities. But Laura Harris delivered on the promise of her looks. She wasn't thin or tiny. She had a womanly gravity that planted her firmly on the ground. She had shape. She had blonde hair and blue eyes and looked like the happiest summer of your life. She had been cast several times for hapless male characters to fall in love with in dramas set in the 1930s and 50s. One of them, Henry remembered, had several scenes of her riding a bicycle in a translucent summer dress, a cheap decision of the director, one for the dads, as they used to say in light entertainment. but the images were fixed in Henry's mind. And in real life, she was intelligent and moral and warm. "Hey, Henry, you're looking a bit thin there," she said. "I've had to lose weight for a part. Welcome to being an actress." "Oh, yes," Tom said. "I heard about your good news. Congratulations. What's this? Henry's in the new Miguel Garcia project, aren't you?" At least I will be when it finally starts filming. "Did you get to meet him?" "I did, of course." "And what's he like?" "There's a lot of myth around him, I know. In person, he's perfectly nice. Scarily clever, obviously. We looked at paintings together in the National Gallery." "Wow, what was that about?" "I'm going to have to leave you two to this discussion," Tom said. "I've got a Skype meeting to attend, trying to get this Somerset Maugham adaptation finally off the ground. I'll see you later for our scheduled boat ride. We're getting all the tourist treats." "Oh, sure, see you then." Tom had clearly heard enough about another director's brilliance. He padded away and back into the hotel. Small and freckled and vulnerable under the drenching sun, he wore a straw trilby for protection. "It was pretty great," Henry said. "We looked at Velasquez, I can never say that word, painting, and talked about suffering and art and religion. All these things are in the film on some level." "Fantastic. So that's my big news. What about you? I've been following your various campaigns, signed a few petitions that come round. I don't do Twitter myself, but I've seen what you've been doing, fighting the good fight. Laura, as you has been mentioned just prior to this scene, has been is a kind of overt and notable feminist, and she's been getting into scraps on Twitter, being that. Laura leaned forward to scratch her shin. "You're better off without it. Better off out of it with Twitter. It ranges from okay to dispiriting to out-and-out vile. Being on there in possession of a vagina can get pretty scary, I can tell you." "A vagina? I've heard of those." "You're in possession of one?" "Yep. And lots of guys on the internet have lots of plans for it, it turns out. Quite a few want to make use of it before or after they kill me." "Jesus, it is horrendous. This conversation has taken a dark turn." "That's what it's like online. Instant escalation. Zero to rape threats in 3 seconds. Well, I do really admire you for doing it. I mean that." "Thanks. It's not all bad, don't worry. There are also a lot of men who want to buy me specific kinds of underwear and or marry me. Now, that I can understand. I have a destined to marry me one the other day." This is his superfan who he's received a letter from. "Even without social media, they find a way. My agent is supposed to stop them getting through to me, but somehow this one slipped through. Maybe it's because she is destined to marry you." "That's a good point. I might need to think about this a bit more." A pause in the conversation. Henry did indeed think about the woman who had written the letter out there, someplace unknown, thinking of him. The slap of water in the pool, the drone of an aircraft, a waiter carried drinks misted with condensation to another table, then tucked his tray under his arm and turned to them. "Can I bring you anything?" He leaned towards them and his posture froze, waiting for a response. He was bald, his head bright in the sun. He squinted. "I don't want anything," Henry said. "Do you?" "Not right now." "Nothing for us," Henry said, and the waiter returned to his station. This is kind of a weird place to be, isn't it? A bit sort of sinister in a way, I suppose. "You think I'm being racist? Scared of Arabs?" Henry looked around at the water. "I guess I am a bit. We are in quite a lively neighborhood. News from this part of the world doesn't tend to be the most reassuring kind. I'm not going to disagree in a way. I'm not sure I'd be here if it weren't in the contract. Workers live in labor camps over here. Did you see them? Bangladeshis and Nepalis out on the building sites on the way from the airport. They die all the time in accidents. They have to work in this insane heat. Just terrible." Laura laughed. "You sound really concerned. That's nice." "That's not fair. I think it's terrible. But you hadn't thought about it before. I bet you hadn't even noticed the brown people out there doing the dangerous work. You were talking about them darn terrorists." "No, I wasn't. No one's going to behead you here, but sure as shit Qatari money is going into the conflicts. They're all over the region in different ways. They fund Al Jazeera too, you know. It's based here. I did know that, as it happens. But to answer your underlying question, you're safe. The waiter just wanted to bring you a pomegranate juice." "Oh, good. I thought he was asking if you wanted to star in a beheading video." "Only you would think of starring in a beheading video. I think he's safe. You're not frightened of these people, are you?" She pointed directly, a quick dart of her finger across her chest. Henry looked around at a family group that had assembled on loungers by the pool, a father sitting next to his son, both wearing swimming trunks. The mother, swathed in cloth, sat upright on a chair. Something about the boy slowed Henry's attention, something different. Oh, that was it. The boy had Down syndrome, the smoothness and roundness of his face, the soft, entirely unselfconscious body. He was adjusting the strap of a diving mask while his father smeared sun cream on his back. The father had a curly wreath of hair around a bald patch, hair on his chest and the slope of his belly. The mother was talking to them both. Henry marveled at them. He had the strange sensation that Laura had magicked them into being, or at least allowed him to see them. Laura's essential bias, despite all she went through with her campaigning, was to like and trust people. And the result seemed to be that good, warm, human people came into view around her. She made Henry feel like a better person. I'm not very frightened, Henry said. Depends what he's planning to do when he's got that mask on. Laura, her expression soft as she gazed at them, said, cute. Henry looked at Laura, looking. He said, this is nice. I've been shut up on my own for a while. It's nice to make contact again. Laura said, sure it is. She looked like a life, a calm and decent way to be. Just going to give you a tiny moment with them again, because I think it captures something about the trust that we no longer can have in the world, and that's eating away at him and the people around him in general, I think, here from the edge of consciousness coming into foreground focus. They're out on a trip on a boat. The skyscrapers needed cooling, and the gardens all had to be watered, the new stadiums. This is, I don't know if you're aware, in Qatar, there's going to be the World Cup, football, soccer World Cup. So it's an insane endeavor that they're building all these air-conditioned stadiums in the middle of one of the hottest places. The new stadiums, all that acreage of grass and massive air conditioning, the need for water was tremendous. The desalination plants were being enlarged. Already the water in the Gulf was thickening, its salt content killing some of the fish. Faisal was on the boat with them explaining all of this. Henry looked at a dhow floating in front of them, at a fisherman walking sure-footed along its length. A lyrical Arabian sight. He responded to what Faisal was telling him with small sounds of deprecation. This was being a tourist in the modern world, enjoying the view while knowing the water was poisoned, the sea overfished, and the sea level rising. Among educated people, this might be the topic of conversation too, at least for a while, a little geopolitical mournfulness between forgetful pleasures. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
That's Adam Folds. Thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of trust issues. It's been a really, really great evening of readings, don't you think? Let's give all of our writers a hand. And now we have some time to gather and chat. I think all five of our writers are still around, so if you'd like to get them to sign books, you're certainly welcome to do that. All of the other great books that we're featuring this week are over here at the McNally's table. I recommend that you get, suckered in and take home tons of books, because it makes all the writers very happy, makes McNally's happy, it makes us happy, it makes you happy. Doesn't that sound about right? We have another big day tomorrow at 12:15. There will be the Nooner at the Millennium. I think Linda Kenyon is there tomorrow doing her transatlantic sailing adventure. In the afternoon book chat, we have a couple of poets, Big Ideas. Bruce, who is on Big Ideas tomorrow? Sonia Voon, right, talking about ancestry and, travel across the world. And tomorrow night we're here with a bunch of poets for our Poetry Bash. So please join us as often as you can. And if you haven't got your hands on a little purple program, do that now and dog ear the corners, and we'll see you again. Thanks so much for coming tonight, and come on forward now.